This is Herb Montgomery with Renewed Heart Ministries, and we welcome you to this week's weekly podcast. Our feature text this week is Luke 12:32, where Jesus says, "It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." And this week, I want to share with you three narratives that happened to me this week that kind of converge together. The way that I want you to imagine them, if you will, it's the way that three streams might have come together to produce a waterfall. And it was like I was standing there in the middle of the current, and these three narratives came together, picked me up off my feet, and just washed me over the edge. And so I want to share those with you and see if the same thing happens for you as well. Narrative number one. This week, two of my children, who will remain nameless to protect the guilty, they were they were having a sibling a moment at the breakfast table. They were just going at it, and the older one was seeking to correct something that the younger one was doing, and the younger one was going to have none of it, and so it was escalating pretty quick. And my wife, I was sitting there reading a book, which I'll talk about in a moment. But my wife, it was too early in the morning for her to deal with this, and she finally just blurted out to the older one, "You are not his mother. I am. And you, if you have a problem with something that he's doing, you bring it to me and let me deal with it. Now apologize." And then after a reluctant apology, she then turns to my son, "This is your sister. And although she was overstepping her place as your sister, she's still your sister. And the words you said to her were unkind. You apologize to her now." And then he gave another reluctant apology. That was the first thing that was going on that morning. Now, narrative number two is, while this was all going on at the breakfast table, I actually was sitting there. I had just picked up a copy of Brian Zahn's new book, Farewell to Mars, which is an excellent book. If you haven't had a chance to pick it up, if you haven't had a chance to read it, recommend it highly. But I was there reading the book at the breakfast table while all of this was going on there. And as Crystal was breaking up this rift between my children, I was reading the section in that book that was concerned with the beginnings of early Mesopotamian violence. And I read this statement. I'll read it to you. It's from Brian Zahn's Farewell to Mars. Brian writes, "This was especially true as conflict arose between the settled agriculture communities and the nomadic shepherding communities, who had differing understandings of land, which is one way of understanding the Cain and Abel story. In the Bible, the genesis of homicide is told like this: Cain, the tiller of the ground, met his sheep-tending brother, Abel, in a field." So I went back right in the context of all of this, I went back to the narrative of Genesis 4 to give it a look. And sure enough, Zond was right on the money. And this could have been the beginnings of early land disputes. That's one way of looking at the Cain and Abel story. And I will look at a few of the sections there. This is from Genesis 4, and I'm just going to highlight a few sections so you can see it. It says, "Now Abel was a keeper of the sheep, and Cain, a tiller of the ground." Now, ancient societies and their societal wars, there was conflict that existed between the stationary tillers of the soil and the nomadic livestock herders. And this conflict is documented. Now, place yourself within that culture and think of this narrative being given to them. Think of the older sibling versus the younger sibling dynamic in every family, especially in that culture. And then fall into the narrative where the older happens to be the oppressive landowner and the younger is the nomadic herder. And imagine that, you know, tillers of the soil being the dominant group. And the herders, they're the hated and the marginalized. And associate the older sibling dynamic with the tillers and the younger oppressed sibling with the herders. Put on those glasses and then go back and read Genesis 4. It says that in the course of time, Cain, and remember that he represented the older, more oppressive stationary landowners, brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground. And Abel, and remember he stands for the younger, the oppressed, the victim, the marginalized, for his part, brought the firstlings of the flock. their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but Cain and his offering he had no regard for. Now, just as with the crucifixion and the resurrection narrative, God in the story of Cain and Abel has regard for the victim of systemic injustice over and against what is often repeated by oppressors when they say God is on our side. The Cain and Abel story shows that God was not on the side of the oppressors, but on the side of the victims of that oppression. And so it says Cain became very angry, and Cain said to his brother Abel, "Let's go out into the field." And when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. And the Lord said, "Your brother's blood is crying out to me from the ground." And here's really the kick in the gut point. Cain must now trade places with Abel. In the story, he must now become the nomad to learn from experience what the nomads go through at the hands of the more stationary landowners. It says, "Now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it'll no longer yield to you its strength, for you will be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth," just like Abel was. Cain said to the Lord, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Today you have driven me away from the soil." And he says, "I will be a fugitive and a wanderer from the earth." So go back and read Genesis 4 with that in mind. So I had my two of my children arguing at the breakfast table. I was reading this story while that was going on in the background. And then narrative number 3, when I left the breakfast table, I discovered that the next section that I was of Luke's gospel that I was going to be spending time with in my morning contemplation was the narrative in Luke chapter 12. And it's just ironic. Here's my siblings arguing. Here's the story of Cain and Abel with the territorial territorialism and the slant there from Zahn's book Farewell to Mars. And then I go to my private time of contemplation in the morning, and this is the passage I read, Luke 12, where you find one brother asking Jesus to be an arbiter, to divide up the inheritance between himself and his older brother. And it says in Luke 12:32, this was the passage that I was going to be contemplating that morning, "It is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Now, again, this is the culmination of a whole context. The context starts out, again, with a brother asking Jesus to be his arbiter, dividing up an inheritance between himself and his brother. And Jesus then embarks on what I think is a radical story that pulls back the thin veneer, hiding the fact that this squabble between these two brothers was just another repetition of history, with Cain about to kill Abel once again. And Jesus contrasts the narratives of human societal arrangements with the narrative of his kingdom. And I want to look at those two narratives here for a moment. The narrative of the world that we all live by, and the narrative of Jesus' kingdom instead. Walter Brueggemann defines the narrative of this world as a narrative of scarcity, anxiety, accumulation, territorialism, and ultimately violence. In other words, we believe that there's a limited amount of all that we need, and then there's only really enough for just a few. And then that scarcity produces an undercurrent of anxiety that leads us to competitive accumulation. And once our accumulation reaches a comfortable level, then all of our anxiety now changes to territorialism. And we become territorial over that which we've worked so hard to accumulate. And then we turn to violence to protect what belongs to us, what we've worked so hard to accumulate. And as I look around, this really is the water that we are constantly swimming in. And we do this politically with land, economically with commodities. We do it intellectually with intellectual property. Hey, I said that first. No, I said that. Or, you know, I got that from so-and-so or whatever. We do it in society or we do it socially with relationships. We do it religiously, and this is key. In the religious world, we do this with the favor of God. There's not enough favor of God to go around for everyone. There's going to be some that are in, and you got to make sure you're part of that group, and others are just going to be shut out. And Jesus in Luke 12, in the place of our broken Cain and Abel narratives of this world, Jesus offers the narrative of his kingdom. Jesus' kingdom narrative is abundance, that there's really enough for everybody, rather than scarcity. This, if you believe it, will create gratitude instead of anxiety, and it produces a sharing rather than accumulation, and a giving freely, a generosity rather than territorialism, and a peacemaking in opposition to violence. And Jesus ends with this idea that you don't have to fight others for your place in this new world that Jesus is creating. He said, it is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. You don't have to fight each other for it. There's enough for everyone. And the culture war in America is really just another example of the narrative of scarcity of power, anxiety and accumulation and territorialism and violence. And as within any war, whether it's political, economic, sociological, or religious, both sides will always have their proof. Both sides believe that they're right, and both sides possess a high level of certitude in their own evidence that their cause is the just one, that their cause is right, and they believe their side is in the right. And then we're left with the decision of trying to figure out ourselves which side is right and which side we should choose. And to try and find out which side is correct in these wars, I think is to miss the point entirely. God's not asking us to discover which side is right and then take that side against the other side. God is asking us to throw that whole system away. He's not going to give us certitude as long as we're going to use that certitude to simply become another Cain, killing another Abel. We're going to have to first learn, I believe, what it means to love our brothers and sisters on this planet, to make room for those that are different from us at the same family table. And only then, really, once we've learned to sit beside each other, even though we're different, only then is it going to be safe for God to give us more light on certain topics. This is also what Wendy van der Waal Gritter calls generous spaciousness. That's another book that I finished this week, and I cannot recommend that book highly enough. That is a phenomenal book. But generous spaciousness, and with that in line, but creating a generous spaciousness for others. Notice Jesus's words again. It is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. It's the Father's good pleasure to give the kingdom to you both. You don't have to fight each other for it. There's enough room in Christ's kingdom for everyone. And some might ask, are you sure it's everyone? I mean, doesn't somebody have to be shut out? Doesn't somebody have to be on the outside? And we have to remember that Jesus practiced an inclusivity that made people feel very uncomfortable. So I would say, yes, it means everyone. It's this truth, I think, that transforms both Cain and Abel, the Cains that are in our society today, as well as the Abels in our culture wars today, to no longer to be a Cain or an Abel, but to be members of a radical new way of arranging life here on earth. In Jesus's new world, remember Paul said, there's no longer a Jew or a Greek, no longer a slave or a free, there's no longer male or female, for all of you are one in Christ Jesus. That's Galatians 3:28. And what I want you to notice is that he picks these comparisons for a reason. Each of these examples in Galatians 3 that Paul mentions are opposing sides, like Cain's and Abel's that were competing for a place in this world, just like Cain and Abel did. These are opposing sides in our societies that are vying for the first place, especially that we're vying for a first place in the culture wars of Paul's own day. Think of Jews versus Gentiles. Think of slave versus free. Think of male versus female. And all of them were competing to have top positions of power. And Paul says no more of it. You're all one family in Jesus Christ. And our challenge today is not to be like the older brother, so smugly assured of the Father's love for us. Our challenge is that we can't stomach looking across the table and saying that our Father includes also those prodigals whom we think should be excluded. Go back and read the parable of the prodigal son through the lens of the Cain and Abel narrative, and there's stuff you'll see in that parable that you missed before that'll blow your mind. Jesus over and over again is whispering to us that if any are lost at last, it's not going to be because they couldn't accept God's love for them. It'll be because they could not accept God's love for someone else that they thought should be excluded. Can you imagine Paul saying today that there's no longer Republican or Democrat, no longer evangelical or secular, no longer straight or gay, no more us versus them, for you are all one in this new world that Jesus is creating. And this, honestly, for many is too much to stomach. Their initial reaction is no, that's wrong, that can't be. But Jesus is actually whispering, yes, this is the kingdom that I came to establish. It teaches us to embrace the other, the us and them, and it encourages us to embrace them as a child of God too. And to believe that it transforms all of us, to no longer be on this side or that side. It transforms all of us into the kind of people that can make up this new world. And I'm not saying, and don't misunderstand me, I'm not saying that it's not the paradigm where everybody's going to be allowed into this world no matter what we are. What I'm saying is that recognizing even our enemies as the children of God too, giving them a place at the table beside of us, whichever side you're on, it changes us into the kind of people that will comprise this new world that Jesus is creating. There's a change, there's a transformation of both parties as they together become that which God is trying to create here. And no one gets in without transformation. That's truth. But the transformation is not to make them more like us or us more like them. It's to drop the us and them and to see each other, although we're different, as fellow siblings, to see each other as both children of God. And we come from the same divine parents, all of us do. And if this causes a Cain-like response inside of your heart space as I share some of these things, I want to encourage you to spend some more time quietly contemplating this week's passage in the context of Luke chapter 12. It doesn't matter whether the territorial accumulation is an inheritance between brothers, whether it's land disputes like between Cain and Abel, or it's a father's inheritance like the prodigal son and the older brother, or whether it's today, you know, the political power that exists between two different ideologies, or maybe a chair position over intellectual ideas, or the coveted title that God is on our side. Whatever it is we're competing for, we're all siblings. We're all children of the same divine parents. And we spend our days, like my children at the breakfast table, in these competitive relationships for top positions where we're going to try to fix the other, or in violent resistance of being controlled and someone trying to fix us. And in reality, we're all children. We're all brothers and sisters squabbling over which one is really favored by our parent the most. And today our world is filled with Taliban Afghans versus American democracy, Republican corporate ideology versus democratic social policy, or closer to my daily world, I spend my days just inundated with one religious adherent after another as we argue with each other to figure out which side is right in one religious debate after another. And could it be that in all of this squabbling, that there's not going to be any new light given on any topic or any philosophy or any ideology? God's not going to give any more light. Our divine parents are not going to give us any more light if we're merely going to use that information as a cane to just kill another Abel and our siblings. And for me, this is a very present possibility. This is real. I recently went through this myself. The evidence that being touted by both sides of an issue, both sides had very convincing evidence, and both sides had excellent points. And I could see the proof of both sides. But when I sought to follow the Jesus story, to embrace the marginalized, to embrace the underdogs in the argument, and to see those involved on both sides as people, both as people with stories, and then to see all of us as fellow siblings of our same divine parents, there was a clarity of understanding that came that I don't know how to put into words. I don't know how to describe in words how clear it actually just appeared. The things I hadn't seen before became overwhelmingly clear, and I found the answers that I was looking for, but only after I had learned not to use these new insights as weapons. Only when we learn to love our enemies is it safe to pull up a chair beside us at the same table for our enemies. Is it safe for God to give us more insights? And in the process, we may discover that the enemy that there needs to be room made for at the table is actually ourselves. Think of the Apostle Paul and his story. And it's the Father's good pleasure to give the kingdom to all of us. We don't have to keep fighting each other for it. It's as if the holidays are coming, and it's not going to be long until we have to take our seats once again around the same family table. And some of us right now are Cains and some of us are Abels. And it's our parents' good pleasure to give us a place at the table. The question we have to ask is, will we take it? Will we be willing to sit beside those who we have in this culture war come to call our enemies? Will we learn to sit beside them? Will we take a place if our place is seated beside them? When we take our place beside each other as members of the same family, at the same family dinner table, the same table, seeing ourselves as siblings of the same divine parents once again, there's lessons that we have to learn first. If this is going to be reality, those lessons are not who is right and who is wrong. The lessons we need to learn are first how to love our siblings or how to love those who are different from us and who nonetheless are our brothers and sisters. They're just different. And it's as others have said, it's not so much about what you believe as the manner in which you believe it. And this week, making its rounds through the social media specifically was Matt Walsh's rant against the Whittington family's decision with their son. And I have to admit that initially I wanted to rant back. I wanted to throw down an exegetical defense from the scriptures that would have just obliterated Matt's position. And I wanted to go on a tirade that honestly would have made Matt's rant look tame. And instead, I was listening at that moment to Siri on my iPhone as Siri read to me Brian Zahn's new book. And the Holy Spirit just whispered, it's time for the Lord's Prayer instead. And so this is what I came up with. Our Father in heaven, wherever Matt Walsh is at this very moment, I pray that you will bless him, that you will bless his circle of closest friends, that you will bless his wife, his children, and his family. Do good to him, good on top of good. Father, bless him with an assurance of your love as well as a deep sense of your love for others. Bless him with tears also, Father, for those who suffer pain, rejection, and violence. Bless him with the capacity to reach out his hand in comfort toward those who are hurting. Don't hold this against him. Lay not this sin against his charge. He doesn't realize what he's doing, Father. And Father, help me too, because I don't recognize when I'm doing this either. Each side knows their cause is just. They believe it, and they can prove it. Save us. Help us also recognize the way of Cain. Help each of us to respond in ways that will not leave the whole world blind. I pray for Jeff and Hillary Whittington that you will give them strength and courage to follow the way of forgiveness. Give them the courage to offer the left cheek, to go the second mile, and pour out on them wisdom, the wisdom they will need to see how they might give their Haitians as well. Your just and fair reign come, Father, when all oppression, violence, and injustice will be put to right. Your dream for restoring all of us be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us all, including Matt and Jeff and Hillary and even little Rylan, give us all what we need for today. And may we learn to forgive as well as we are forgiven, to love as well as we are loved, and to restore and to heal as well as to be restored and be made whole. May we not be dragged as scapegoats to unjust trials, but delivered from the way of the accuser. For yours is the kingdom and the power, and it's your good pleasure to give us this kingdom, even to the least of us. We don't have to fight each other for it. Your kingdom come, Father, upon us all. And some will argue with this, and they'll say, but Herb, you don't know what they're doing. You don't know what the other side is doing. I know and I hear you, but what I also hear are the words of God and the words of my wife to our children around the breakfast table this week. It's as if God is saying, you are not their parent. You're not, just like my wife said, you're not their mother. I am. And if you have a problem with something they are doing, then you bring it to me and you let me deal with it. They are your brother or your sister, and as your sibling, there is no excuse for you not to treat them as family. You are to love them. And so I'll close with Paul's words in his letter to the Romans this week. Romans 12:14-20. Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse. Live in harmony with one another and do not think you are superior. Do not repay anyone for evil. If it is possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do not take revenge, my dear friends, but leave room for God's wrath. And think of once again Crystal's words that you're not their mother, I am. Leave room for God's vengeance, for it is written, it is mine to avenge, I will repay, says the Lord. On the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him something to drink. We're all children of God, and remember, you're not their parent. God is. Your job as their sibling, whether you agree with them or not, is to make room for them within the same family, realizing that we're all on a journey, we're all in process. And if they are doing something to you that you believe to be wrong, don't take the punishment of that wrong into your own hands. Take whatever it is that they're doing and give it to your heavenly parent. And then cooperate with whatever our heavenly parent shows you. And it may be about them, it may be about yourself, but whatever needs discipline, it'll be disciplined. But remember, it's discipline, not punishment. And whatever the result, it is our first priority to listen and cooperate with our divine parent, and it is our second priority to love everyone, to love all, even our enemies, as members of our same family, as our they are children of God too. They are our siblings. And Jesus redefined Moses's word, his term neighbor or kinship, this kinship bond, to include the enemies of the Jews as well. And it's no wonder that in Luke 4, when Jesus tried to do this, when he talked about God's favor, not just on us, but on them too, it's no wonder that they grabbed Jesus and tried to throw him off a cliff. Here's one more statement from Brian Zahn's Farewell to Mars. In light of the cross, we are to realize that if what we have built on Cain's foundation is capable of murdering the Son of God, the whole edifice needs to come down. Wherever this finds you this week, Jesus' message to you is, it is the Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. You don't have to fight anyone for it. There's enough manna for everyone. It belongs to all of us as a gift. Heart group application. This week, I want you to consider what group in our world today frightens you the most. And number one, I want you to take this group to Jesus. And as you sit with him in prayer, while you and he together contemplate this group, I want you to also contemplate the narratives of Luke 12:13-32, and Genesis 4:1-14. And then write down, number two, write down what Jesus shows you. And then number three, share with your heart group this week what you discover in your time with Jesus. Wherever this finds you this week, keep living in love. Keep following Jesus into the restoration of God's original purpose for the human family. We're all brothers and sisters, and we're all going to have to learn how to sit around that family dinner table once again, until the only world that remains is a world where love reigns. I love you guys. I'll see you next week. Mm-hmm.